CF United, the premier Cold Fusion Conference by TerraTech Programming. Created by developers for developers.
Good morning, everyone. Just had the little start flag, first session of the conference. It's a little nerve-wracking after the keynote. Everyone enjoy the keynote? Good stuff. Are we glad to see Tim back? Yes, isn't that good? Okay, Cold Fusion Components and Factories. How many people here are using CF7? Good. CF6.1? Okay, how many people are still on CF5? Anyone on an earlier version? Okay. This is all about components, so it's going to be CF6.1 and up. And those other engines. What I'm going to do is talk through some of the issues that people tend to find as they move from traditional sort of procedural Cold Fusion code to the new sort of OO think using components. Really what we find is that we're used to a particular type of complexity in our procedural applications. We know that they're a little hard to maintain because they do tend to turn into spaghetti. But as we reorganize the code into objects, as we're told is a good thing, we actually start to hit a different type of complexity, which is all these objects and all of their interdependencies. And as your application grows pretty big, this can actually get pretty daunting in and of itself. So what I'm going to do is look at how these complexities arise and some of the techniques for managing those complexities and look at some ways to automate that, including a framework, because, of course, as everyone knows, I love frameworks. Who am I? I am part of the hosted services group at Adobe. That's the group that's responsible for BreezeCentral.com and PDF online services. So you can go to the website, you can have a subscription that lets you upload any number of documents, convert them to PDF and have them sent back to you, or you can actually email a PDF document to a particular mailing address and it will come back with just the text extracted from PDF and a whole bunch of stuff like that. And of course the Breeze system. How many people have used Breeze? So you're all using the stuff that my team works on. I actually run a very small group inside that organization that's building out sort of the next generation software infrastructure for future hosted offerings. So I can't talk much about what I do. I'm hoping that at a future conference I will be able to talk in detail about what my group will have done by that point. So don't ask me too many penetrating questions about that. For those of you who know me, you'll know that I was at Macromedia formerly for about 5 years as the senior architect of the whole IT division, and ultimately was responsible for creating the team that built the Macromedia.com and Adobe.com system now, which is all powered by Cold Fusion. Been around for a long time, been doing OO for a long time. I'm a relative newbie at CF because I picked it up after Macromedia bought Allaire. So I've only been doing Cold Fusion for 5 years, and my Cold Fusion world has always been essentially CFMX. So CFCs have always been part of my Cold Fusion world. I'm going to go through some component basics, make sure that we're all on the same page, look at the life cycle of components and how dependencies arise. I will introduce the concept of factories, which is a way to manage object life cycles, and then look briefly at Cold Spring. If you want to learn more about Cold Spring after this presentation, Dave Ross is here, he's sat over there, and he's doing a presentation at 3 o'clock on Thursday. So that'll be the talk to go to if you want more detail than I'm going to give. So first off, let's look at a component and sort of the anatomy of a component. We have a CF component tag at each end of it, we have some CF functions in the middle, and we can have code interspersed in between those. So a lot of people perhaps don't know that you can have code in between the functions, they know you can have code at the top. What happens is that Cold Fusion gathers up all of that code that isn't inside a CF function tag, packages it all together, and executes it whenever you create one of these components. So if you put code down the bottom, it'll still get executed before anything else when you create one of those components. So you create and initialize a component. You create it using CreateObject or CFObject. It loads it up into memory, and it runs all of that code that isn't inside a CF function. And for initialization, we typically call one or more methods on the object to set it up the way that we need to use it. So after you've created and initialized it, you're going to use some methods on that. And we're not really interested in that part for this talk, because that's when the object is live and you're just interacting with it. And then when you stop using it and you no longer have any references to the object, the Java system under ColdFusion comes along and sort of vacuums the object up and puts it back in memory. And we're not really very interested in that in this talk, because we actually don't have any control over it. Unlike Java and C++, ColdFusion has no way to call methods when an object dies. So we're focusing on creation and initialization in this talk. Here's two forms that are equivalent: call create object or calling CF object. Exactly the same, depends whether you prefer tag-based syntax or script-based syntax. This next one creates an object and calls a method on it. This is something you have to be careful of. If you call CF invoke and you specify a component name, the first thing it will do is create an instance of that object and therefore run that code that's loose inside the component, and then it will call your method on it. So because all of these actually run that pseudo-constructor code, code that's outside any of the functions, it's a good idea to keep it very simple. And it's also a good idea to keep it right at the top, because it's sort of the first thing that happens when a component comes to life. So for maintenance, it's much easier for people to read if they say CF component, here's a bunch of code, oh, here's a method. I know this stuff gets executed. They're not going to expect to dig around in the component and find other pieces of code. So don't do that. And don't put creation of other objects in that code. Don't put in security checks and things like that. Because if you use the CFC Explorer and you browse to the component directly, it will also instantiate the object and it will run any of that code. So if you've got complicated code in that pseudo constructor that's going off creating other objects, every time you browse to it to look at the documentation, you're creating all those other objects. So keep it very, very simple. Just initialize some static variables, just simple data types. Now, we don't have a constructor in ColdFusion. We have a de facto standard, which is to have a method called init that returns this, has the return type of the same name as the component. And even if it does nothing, it's a really good idea to have one of these in your CFCs that just says return this. And you'll notice that there's actually a situation if you're using Mark II, defining your own init is problematic, because Mark II sort of assumes that objects that extend the framework are going to have an init method, so you actually have to call it configure. Everywhere else, it's init. Always write an init method. Get used to doing that. And when you're creating and initializing, do it in one step. Do a create object and call init immediately. And this is why it's important that the init method returns this. So here we can see that we are creating an object, some.cfc name, and we're initializing it immediately with arguments. The same with the CF component, the CF invoke tag. Now here's one where we're using CF invoke, we're specifying the component name, and we're relying on the fact that that creates the instance for us and then invokes the method. So we can create the object and call in it to initialize the object in one line. So either of those are good practice. Now, anyone hazard a guess why you shouldn't say obj becomes create object of this, and then on the next line, obj.init? Anyone hazard a guess? It's to do with multi-threading and shared scopes. Typically, you'll have code that's going through at startup, and it's creating and initializing objects. Well, if you just create the object and assign it somewhere, you've got other code running, it's going to find that object in existence and start to try and use it, but you haven't initialized it yet. Whereas if you always call createObject.init, you're not storing an uninitialized object. So that's an important trick to remember if you're doing you are all doing multi-threaded applications, whether you know it or not. Now, in terms of types of components, there's really two primary types of components. The first one is people, places, and things, essentially. These are pretty concrete. They have state, they have attributes. They're typically created per request or per session as your application operates. They're things like a user object, a shopping cart object, perhaps a product object that you pulled out of the database. Then the other type of object is services and infrastructure, and they generally don't have state, but they might cache data for efficiency. And they often are sort of management things. So you might go to you might have a tax service that you can say, okay, you know, calculate me tax on this amount for this state. It doesn't really belong to anything else, it just sort of exists. The people, places, and things, these are your real-world stuff. A person that has a first name and a last name. And as I say, typically you're getting them as needed. You're loading them from a database, you're creating them on the fly from a form, and storing them back to a database, perhaps. And so they tend not to have too many dependencies. They're relatively self-contained. Services and infrastructure, on the other hand, tend to represent concepts and processes, and they tend to depend on other services. Classic example is that a data access object needs to know about the data source. It needs to know where to go and get data. And if you have some sort of controller object, it needs to know about your data access object in order to be able to tell it to go get some data. So your controller needs to know about your business objects, your controller needs to know about your data access objects. And you can see this hierarchy of dependencies beginning to build up. And the other point to remember about services and infrastructure is that they're generally created once at application startup. So you build all this stuff, it doesn't change for the life of your application, you stick it in application scope, and you're done with it. It just sort of sits there, and then you call it as needed to do things. So what does that look like? Well, we might have code to create a data source object, and it might have more than just the name of the data source, it might have username, password, and so on. And then you create your data access object, and you pass in the data source. And that looks pretty innocuous, but it's the start of the slippery slope that says, when I create things, I have to know what order to create them in, and how to initialize other objects with these first objects I've just created. So the problems with this is that, first of all, create object and CF object require the path to the CFC. And as anyone who's taken some third-party package of CFCs and tried to put it somewhere else in the application soon finds, that's a problem, because you can't just move them around because the paths are hard-coded everywhere. And in general, just having hard-coded strings throughout your code is a bad thing. It's very hard to maintain. You can't move them around. You can't swap out one implementation for another. Who here does unit testing? Yeah, not very many of you. How many of you do it with some sort of automated test framework like CFUnit or CFCUnit? Okay. So the idea behind those is that you are able to set up a test harness to test units of functionality like a CFC. Well, if you've got a lot of dependencies between things, it's very, very hard to create an isolated part of your application and then test it without having the rest of your application there. So one of the things that people do in the testing world is they say, well, I'm going to have a data access object, but I'm going to have it talk to a known data source with test data in rather than my production data so that I can control how it behaves. Or I'm going to talk to this business object, and I'm going to have a stub data access object that always returns the same data. So again, I can test just the behavior of the business object. Now, if you think about what happens with creating the dependencies, it actually makes it very, very hard to mix and match real objects and test objects, because again, you've got these hard-coded dependencies. And the other thing is, who owns the creation process? If the controller needs the data access object, and that in turn needs the data source object, who creates this stuff? Well, you have to create the data source object, you then have to create the data access object and initialize it, and does that happen in the controller? Well, you could have the controller do all of this, and the controller knows about everything, and you have to keep changing the controller every time anything moves around, but it's not really the controller's responsibility. So you've also got this question of, if you move it outside, someone has to tell the controller where it is. So there's always a dependency somewhere. So the first thing that we can do is we can create a factory. We're used to the idea of factories making things for us. You know, a toy factory makes toys. We don't really care how. We know we get toys out of the toy factory. A car factory makes cars. Again, we don't need to know how to build an automobile to be able to use one. So we could have a factory object, and we ask it for objects. And essentially, the application doesn't care how the factory builds the object as long as it can reliably say, give me a data access object. Doesn't care that the factory has to go off and figure out how to do the initialization. So the factory encapsulates your dependencies. We know encapsulation is a good thing. The rest of the code just depends on the factory object. This is traditionally called the factory method pattern. So you call a method, it constructs something and hands it back to you. So we would, in the factory, have the code that creates the data source and the data access object, and then the data access object method could actually call the getDataSource method, and so the dependencies can be wired in, but the actual creation and initialization of objects can be in individual methods. So it's fairly maintainable. Inside your code, you'd ask the factory for a data access object. You wouldn't care how it got constructed or what it did. But this, of course, means that something has to create the factory, and your application has to know about it. And that the factory itself has to know how to initialize things means somewhere it needs to get the initialization data. So typically, at application startup, you'd create a factory object, and you'd initialize it somehow. We've solved some problems. We now have no hard-coded paths in our application code, which is good. We can now move our CFCs around or change the implementation because the only place that knows where the CFCs really live is the factory. So if we want to mock out some of the application, we just modify the factory and tell it, well, we're going to create mock objects for these instead, and it'll happily build everything. The application will run, and the application won't care that the factory is giving it mock objects as opposed to real objects. And the factory can do some of that initialization for us, that tedious part of wiring in all those constructor arguments. But of course, we still have this problem about where it gets that from. So if you're going to be doing a lot of unit testing, you're going to be changing how you assemble your test harness a lot. So at least we've moved it to a factory, but now you're changing your factory all the time, and that feels a bit odd. And initialization is still just this royal pain. You either pass everything into the factory, or you hardwire it in the factory, or you put a configuration file that the factory knows about and reads. So that still sort of feels ugly to me. Well, we could create more factories. And first, this might sound like a silly idea, but one of the things you can do, and it's a good solution for supporting multiple databases, is to have a factory that knows how to create data access objects for a given database. So if you've got an application that's going to run on MySQL and it's going to run on SQL Server, you can have a factory that generates MySQL data access objects and a factory that generates SQL Server data access objects that have the same set of methods. And then at startup, you just choose which factory you're going to use, and your application just says, give me a data access object. It doesn't need to know about databases. It doesn't need to know which factory it's talking to. And that's actually something called the abstract factory pattern, where you have this abstract factory that you just say, well, just give me these things. I don't care how you do it. And then it'll have multiple implementations that do different things. And you can solve the testing problem to some extent by having a testing factory and a real factory. And you call methods on the same, you call the same methods across both, and you can get mock objects back, and you can get real objects back. As an example, at application startup, we might check which database we're going to be talking to and create the appropriate factory object. It's the only place where the database type needs to be coded into your application. So now we can create different sets of objects. We can swap our implementations. We can do a fair bit towards our unit testing. And that's great. You know, we've really helped move all those hard-coded things out of our application, so we've got a much better structured application, much easier to maintain. We've still got this problem with initialization, though. That's really nasty. You've still got all these hard-coded constants somewhere. We need a better scheme for managing that, so that something can actually build things and actually wire in all the raw data that we need. And the dependencies are still hard-coded. Your explicit code in your factory says, oh, I need to go get one of these things, build that first, and then I'm going to wire it into this thing I'm building. So you still have all your constants and your dependencies spread across what is probably quite a large factory object that you've had to write yourself and that you have to maintain yourself. So you might have hundreds of lines of code in this factory with lots of very similar methods. And it actually is quite easy to introduce bugs at that point because so much of the code is so similar. So a possibility here is sort of a generic super factory. The idea that instead of hand coding the factories, you use something that really understands the sort of the role of a factory, but is generic enough to let you apply it to your own code. Chili Beans is something some of you might have heard of if you've worked with Model Glue in the early days. Joe Reinhardt included a small bean factory with Model Glue that lets you specify in a configuration file the names and types and properties of beans and therefore some of their dependencies. That's been deprecated in favor of ColdSpring, which is a much more powerful factory. And is essentially, to some degree, a port of Spring from Java. And Dave's going to cringe at that. But this is a very, very powerful generic engine that understands concepts of dependencies and initialization and injection of data. So you can read about it on the coldspringframework.org. You can go to Dave Ross's talk on this. And I'm actually going to go through sort of an introduction to some of this, and he's going to talk in a lot more detail about it. First off, we do everything through an XML configuration file, which shouldn't be a surprise. People seem to be doing that all the time. Okay. Can we get the volume up in the room? Okay. I will stand more tethered to the stand so that people can hear better. So we move our configuration out into an XML file. And this, you know, XML's everyone's favorite flavor these days. Part of the reason is that there's a lot of tool support for it. So, you know, if you have XML files, you tend to have very good ways of manipulating XML files and visualizing them. One of the things the XML file does is it separates the actual type of the CFC from the symbolic name that you're going to use to talk about it. So if you have a tax service, you can just call it tax service. And it can live anywhere on the file system, and you can specify the path to that CFC in the XML file. And then your application just says, give me the tax service. So you can move things around, you can swap in types because you don't have them hard-coded. It also has a way to specify how you pass data into constructors. And how you set up other properties on objects. And I'll show you a configuration file in a minute. And probably the most important part of this is that it understands how to figure out dependencies. Because if you say, well, in order to create a data access object, you're going to need this data source object, ColdSpring will look at that and say, oh, data source object, I've got that over here. I'd better go build that first. And you can have very complex dependencies. You can even have circular dependencies, which do crop up in some applications where you have two objects that both need references to each other in order to function. And ColdSpring will figure out that it has to construct an object, construct this object, sort of inject an uninitialized version in, because nothing's running except ColdSpring, and then it can inject an uninitialized version here and then initialize these objects and sort of go through these phases to build everything up. So it really does help because you don't have to worry too much about this machinery. It's magic. It just happens. And basically what happens at the end of the day is your application says, okay, give me a foo. And ColdSpring goes off, figures out where it is, figures out what else it needs to build it, builds all of those things, wires them all together, sets up the constructors, injects all the other properties, and gives you back a foo object that you don't have to care how it got there. You don't have to care about anything about it. It's fully constructed, fully initialized. You just run with it and use it. So now we have no hard-coded paths. We can move our CFCs around. All we have to do is change the XML declaration. It handles all of our initialization for us because it's out there in a separate file. It manages all of our dependencies. We can create different types of objects at will just by swapping things in the XML file. So you don't have to change anything in your code. You just go into the XML file and say, oh, you know, well, we're going to use this revised version of this service. And the nice thing is also that you can version control your configuration independently of your source code. One of the things that we do at Adobe.com is the configuration of our applications is based in an external file in terms of variables and path names and so on, and there's quite a bit of data and metadata that we keep about each server and each environment. And our build system actually goes through and it pulls out sort of the base level and puts it in a directory and then overlays additional files and code on top of that. And then our application code doesn't have to change at all. It simply goes and says, okay, give me the configuration. Now, we're not currently using Cold Spring. We've kind of evolved this system. If we were using Cold Spring, we would simply have XML config files for each environment and just have the build system move the correct one into our target directory. So we could make our lives a lot easier by adopting this, but we have a lot of legacy code. We have hundreds of thousands of lines of ColdFusion running 50 applications on Adobe.com, and about a quarter of those are powered by Mark II. So my new team, as we build out ColdFusion applications, we're going to be using Cold Spring right from the get-go. And some of my team who are Java people, they're already very familiar with Spring from Java. So for them, if they're going to be dipping into ColdFusion, they're going to say, well, you know, I know Spring. This uses the same XML format. Sure, I can write code in ColdFusion that works exactly like my Java code. So they're going to be happy with that. So let's look through an example, work through one, and see what it really means. This is a very abbreviated CFC. It doesn't have any argument types or return types or hints or anything like that. It's very stripped down just to show you some code. So it has a very simple constructor in it that takes the data source name and just remembers it. Variables.name becomes arguments.name and returns this. So always have your init method return this. And then we can have a getter, get name, that returns the name of the data source, and there'd be get user, get password, and so on. Here's our data access object. Now, it's a very boring data access object because it doesn't actually have any of the SQL in to do any data access, but this is what we need to show this example. So we have, again, a constructor, an init method, and it takes a data source object at construction time, and again, it just remembers that data source. And if you need to get it, you do get DS is probably going to be a private function that the create, read, update, delete methods would call to use in the CF query statements. So they'd say CF query data source equals pound get DS dot name. And so it's nicely encapsulated. At initialization time, assuming we're not using one of the MVC frameworks, we would create the Cold Spring bean factory. And so you see this sort of nasty coldspring.beans.defaultXML factory type. It's pretty much the only hard-coded thing you need. And you just create it, initialize it, squirrel it away in application scope, and then you tell it to load the beans from the config file. And I'll show you the config file in a minute. And anywhere else throughout the application, you ask Cold Spring for a bean. So in your application code, to get at your data access object, you say application.cs.getBeanDataAccessObject. Returns fully initialized data access object. Behind the scenes, it's resolved the dependencies, it's figured out that you needed the data source object, it went off and created that and initialized it with the name that you specified in the XML file. It then started to build the data access object. It calls the constructor, it passes in the object it's already created, and will do any other properties, and then finally it will give you back this fully realized object without you having to write any code yourself. Let's look at the XML configuration. Nice and simple, it's all on one page. I'm going to talk through it line by line. Essentially, it's an XML file that says, here's a bunch of beans. And then each bean has a definition within there that tells it what the constructor might look like and what any additional properties there are that need to be wired in. So the first thing in here is the definition of the data access object. So we have a bean, we give it an ID, and the type specifies the actual name of it on the file system. So it happens to be currently in cfcs.mysql.dao. Notice if we wanted to switch to SQL Server, all we'd need to do would be to change MySQL to SQL Server, MS SQL, or whatever you called it, and just rerun the application, and bang, it's talking to a different type of database. The constructor. It says, this object has a constructor, an init method, and it has a constructor argument called DS. And that tells ColdSpring that whatever value follows, I'm going to pass in and say DS equals this value when I call the init method. Now, you could also use property tags. This is a way to say, these are values that I need in my object. I don't need them in at construction time. But before you give me back the object, I want you to call set method on the object. So if we'd done this as a property called DS, ColdSpring would build the object, call init, and then call set DS. And it'll call set whatever for any of the properties you specify. And then embedded in this, we have a bean that has no ID. But it does have a type. It's our data source object. And it's an unnamed object that we're passing to the constructor. So one of the things that if you have an object that you're constructing simply to hand into something else, and you don't need it anywhere else, you don't need to give it a name. In most cases, you are going to say bean ID equals. In this case, again, we have the constructor arg. It has a name. We specify the constructor. We specify the value. And you can specify complex values. You can specify structs, arrays, and other objects. And the way you specify another object is to say it's a reference to a bean with a name. So instead of passing this in place like I do here, I could have said ref bean equals data source and then had a separate bean ID equals data source definition in the XML file. And you can see at the bottom there the code that ColdSpring will execute on your behalf. Having created the data source object, it will initialize it with name equals testDB. Now, ColdSpring can do a lot of stuff. You can have multiple XML files, so you can segment out the parts of your application, and you can actually load multiple XML files in, and it will sort of assemble the entire cast of objects from those. That actually allows you to override definitions. So when you're doing unit testing, you can actually say, OK, here's my application, and here are the definitions for my mock objects, and I will load that definition simply over the rest of it. And then when you ask for an object, ColdSpring will look in and say, here's a definition of an object, but it's a mock object. It came from your testing XML file. It provides seamless integration with Mark II and Model Glue. Both of those frameworks know how to integrate with it and use it to provide a facility to actually wire things into your controllers. So normally when you're building those framework applications, your controller logic actually has to know about how to build the business model. And this takes that away. This says, I have a method here called setModel, and ColdSpring will go away and build all your model objects, and it says, you've got something called model, I'll go off and build that for you automatically. And because you have a setModel method on your controller, I will call that and pass in this big business model that I've created for you. So a lot of automation there, which means you don't need constructors in your controllers. It also has flash remoting support. There's some machinery in ColdSpring, which I haven't actually delved into, that builds things like a facade for some business logic. So if you have some CFCs that you've built and you want to reuse those in a Flex application or a rich internet app or through web services, you can essentially just say, create me a remote facade for this and deal with mapping of all the types. I don't want to have to deal with it. And it will go off and it will generate the code it needs. And then there's aspect-oriented programming. How many people have actually heard of AOP? That's a big percentage of people. That's very encouraging. And it's definitely a whole talk in and of itself. But one of the really powerful things about it is it essentially allows you to modify an application after the fact. So, you've written an application. You're having problems with it running. So you want to put some debugging in so that you can see what calls are being made across what objects. Well, you don't really want to have to crack open the source code and dig through it and actually start putting in CFlog calls at the beginning and end of every function. Well, AOP lets you not do that. You create something called advice, and in this case, the advice would log things. And then you can tell ColdSpring, by the way, when you build these objects, I want you to sort of weave the advice in so that if a call is made to a method in this object, what will actually happen is it'll call the advice, call the object's method, and then go back through the advice. And so you can actually add tracing and logging to objects without touching their code. It's very, very powerful. You can add security and a whole bunch of other things. If you download my framework sample code from my blog, one of the examples in there uses ColdSpring to apply security, where I wrote the application with no security. Anyone could go in and edit the data. And then I had a separate piece of code that checks whether you're a logged-in user and throws an exception if you're not. And then the framework has a thing that says, if I get an exception that's a security exception, I'll show someone the login page. Because, you know, obviously something happened in the application that they weren't authorized to do. And then I simply just weave that in. And so the application thinks it's talking to those parts of the application that dig into the code and, you know, read and write stuff from the database. But in fact, it's talking to the stuff that ColdSpring generated for me, which in turn is talking back to my original code. And it's completely transparent. So you can change the security model without touching the original application. Now, as you start getting into this, as you're building out bigger and bigger OO applications, you're going to get that complexity just growing. I talked to someone and they said, well, you know, I've got hundreds of objects. In fact, who listened to the Matt Woodward and Pete Farrell podcast? In one of the recent ones, they were talking about how you structure your applications. And Matt Woodward said, well, you know, I put all my beans in one directory, and I put all my data access objects in another directory. And Peter Farrell said, yeah, that's interesting, but when I build applications, I group things by functionality. So I would have a person directory, and that would have the person bean and the person data access object and the person gateway and all the other stuff. You know, or perhaps a slightly larger grain piece, like a security area that would have all of the user management and security stuff in. And the comment was that if you have a beans directory and you're just pumping all your beans in, you might have an application with hundreds of beans as it grows. You know, I was talking to someone the other day who has a Mark II app with 1,000 event handlers in it. That's pretty big. So, you know, you're building this stuff, you've got all these forms, you've got lots and lots of beans, so you're going to be dealing with very, very complex dependencies between a lot of the objects in your system. So you don't want to have to continue managing that by hand. And in fact, Matt and Peter were talking about the fact that they're using ColdSpring as they're developing Mark blog, which is going to be a Mark II-based sample application of a blog. But they're using ColdSpring in there immediately to manage all the data access objects, because they want it to be supporting multiple databases. So they're going to build a data access object set for MySQL, one for SQL Server, one for Oracle, and so on, and then use ColdSpring to pick the right one at startup. And so that's the power of the system. And you could just write your own factories, and a lot of people get into this simply by doing that. They realize that they've got create objects scattered all over their code. And in fact, if you look at Simon Horwith's sensible assembly methodology, where his pet market code, you'll see that that's pretty much the first thing he does. He has a factory component, and all of the other objects are created inside that factory object. So anywhere the application needs one of these things, it goes off to the factory and says, yeah, give me this, give me that. But if, again, you've got hundreds of objects in your application, your factory's going to get really nasty, complex, and it's got to manage all the dependencies and all of the initialization. So, you know, you're going to hit a limit with that as well. And that's really why the frameworks can help you sort of avoid that repetitive, tedious stuff of all that hand-coded thing. And to be honest, most of the factory methods are going to be, you know, create foo, and inside that it'll say, you know, cfset var foo equals create object component mycfcs.foo.init with some arguments return foo. You know, how many hundred times do you want to write that? Some people do. Some people love writing all that stuff. So, you know, I think ColdSpring is a really good solution for this. I think it's very, very rich and powerful. It's got a lot of features that I haven't even scratched the surface of in my own code yet, let alone, you know, talked about. And it really does help separate all of that complexity and frankly, housework from your application itself. So your application can be nice and clean and self-contained, and you don't have to worry about all those dependencies. How many people here have programmed in C++? Wow, that's a big proportion. So you're all very familiar with this idea of housekeeping on objects, because you know you have to create the object, and you have to figure out, oh yeah, you know, I remembered I created one of these objects here, I'd better destroy it over here because it doesn't do it automatically for you. And you end up spending so much of your time creating and managing objects and destroying them, you know, or you say, well, you know, we need pool management, so you have to create even more complex ways of creating these objects. With ColdSpring, if you've got something that's a singleton object, you ask ColdSpring for it 4 times. The first time it figures it out, builds it, sticks it in its cache, and then the next time you just get back the same object. It says, yeah, here it is. I already built it. You know, so it's really good for that too. I would not use ColdSpring to manage the people, places, and things. As you probably gathered from the amount of smarts inside ColdSpring, it's very good at dealing with the big, heavy services that you would create at startup. But you don't want to be using it to create your person object and have it going through all that dependency analysis on your person object on every request. So that's not what it's designed for. And that's a case where people, places, and things tend to be relatively simple, straightforward objects with simple data attributes. And there, a custom factory that's specific to your business model is a reasonable thing. So I'm not saying throw out the factories completely. And I'll open it up for questions. I know it's a fairly short presentation. I'm happy to be caught in the bar and ask more questions about this. Question then. The question was, ColdSpring integrates very well with Model 2, Model Glue, and Mark 2. What about Fusebox? The integration with Mark 2 and Model Glue has come about really because they're very focused on OO, and so you pretty much have to be building everything with objects to be using those frameworks. Fusebox lets you write in a procedural style. It lets you write objects if you want. So the sort of objects are optional aspect of it has meant that it hasn't yet got into the situation where people are finding that the problems they have managing all of their objects are there for the Fusebox folks. Now, having said that, Fusebox 5, release candidate 1, went out on Fusebox.org last night. So you can all go download it. And if you don't want to go download it, you can come and get it off my thumb drive. And that does have quite a few enhancements which deal with making manipulation of objects a little easier. So the sort of the syntax for dealing with invoke and instantiate of objects is clearer. It actually has an application initialization phase now. So I'm hoping that that will encourage Fusebox developers to start doing more with CFCs. And then the other thing that I think we'll see, because it has a sort of extensible grammar, is I think we'll see additions to it that actually allow people to do the integration with ColdSpring in a nice, clean way within the XML grammar. So that's what I'm hoping happens there. Question at the front. Okay. The question was, if you have a fairly large OO application that doesn't use factories, what are some of the sort of pitfalls you can run into as you migrate towards factory-based code? Really, what I would recommend there is that you set up a test suite first, and you test the existing application as much as possible, and then pick individual object types and move them to a factory and hunt through the code, because this is what it's going to be about. Do the find and replace on all of those create objects for a given type and say, okay, this is a service type object, so we're going to move it to this factory here and just go through it. Each create object, you should just be able to replace one create object at a time with a call to factory.getObject and test. Good, I haven't broken anything. Okay, move the next one over, test. Okay, I'm pretty confident that I can just move all of these over. Move them all over, test. Application still works. Okay, let's go after the next type, and so on. And literally do the migration over time. A big bang migration, while possible, will tend to be very disruptive and painful. So if you can weave it into sort of ongoing maintenance of the application on a day-to-day basis, that will really help make it easier. And over time, you'll get increasing benefits from having everything in the factory. Answer your question?
I did. I had
another one.
Sure. Is there extra consideration when you're designing objects?
So the question was, are there things to bear in mind when you're designing your objects to make it easier to move to factories down the road? Think carefully about what an object needs to be constructed and to be useful versus the other things that an object might need as part of its day-to-day life. So you don't want a situation where you can create an object that you can't use because you don't give it enough initialization data in the constructor. But there are quite often times where you can have an object that has enough data to run, but it might not have enough data for a particular context in an application, and that would be the decision between having a constructor that takes 10 arguments versus having a constructor that takes 5 arguments and then 5 set property methods on it. So it really is about, you know, what the application is going to do internally. Also, try and keep the interfaces to your objects nice and clean. So if a method on an object simply returns part of its data, call it get instance name, where it's returning variables.instance name. If you're going to set a property on something, just call it set instance name and pass in the new property. So stick to using standard setter getters so that when you move to a factory, the factory can actually still call all of those on your object. And of course, call your constructor init, because that's what the systems expect. So basically, it's kind of just best practices. Other questions? Yeah, so the question for anyone who didn't hear it was, can ColdSpring help with multiple versions of libraries being used in sort of essentially a shared environment where you've got multiple clients, multiple applications running, but they need to use different versions of the library? And the answer is yes, because what you can do is you can either have the application say, okay, I'm going to read from a local ColdSpring XML file, and that will define the files I'm going to use for my model, and then simply have a dedicated XML file for each installed application. Or you could actually version those and say, well, you know, you're going to be working on version 1.2 of XML because that's the one that fits in with this particular version of the back end. So again, it does allow you to version control your configuration separate from your source code. And it'll also allow you much more control over which versions of elements of the model. So yeah, you certainly can. And you could have an XML file that might have, you know, blobcfc 3.5.2, which is actually what I'm running, blobcfc 3.6, and they're all different elements in the XML file, and then the application can just say, give me blob 3.5.2 as a bean, and ColdSpring would go off and figure out how to build all of that. Now, some work would have to be done on the back end to make it kind of factory compliant, but yes, the model is certainly applicable to that. Down the front, though.
How do you recommend handling deployment from either local or test or to production servers if you have, you know, simple things like username and passwords that are different, that would be within your configuration file?
Mm-hmm. So the question was, how do you handle deployment across dev, QA, production when the configuration is different on each one? Well, there's several approaches. One of the things that we do at Adobe is we have the idea of the build system constructing your configuration based on which environment you're building to. So there's a base level configuration, and then there's an overlay configuration for the QA environments and a further overlay for production. We've actually got direct overlays for individual servers. So the build system knows how to build the one true configuration file for a given server in a given tier of the environments. So that's one possibility. The other thing is, of course, if you separate it out into multiple files, you can have your core application XML, and then anything that differs across those can be in a separate XML, and you only have that on each server. And you could handle that as something that does not get built as part of your general build process. It just doesn't get overwritten. So in the case of this with a data source, the data source XML might be a separate file that isn't just built to the server. So the main application XML gets built out to each server, but your data source XML is part of the configuration, perhaps in a separate directory, that's unique to that server. And when you fire the application up, it'll load in the main XML, and then it says, well, I now need to load in my environment-specific XML. And that will override definitions and add to those definitions. So it can be very helpful for that. That's your question?
Yes.
Cool. Got anyone else? Yeah. Did everyone hear that down that end? Yeah. It's actually, the Adobe approach is similar in some ways because we actually do have a small configuration file for each environment that is then included into the main configuration and used to drive the rest of the configuration. It's not quite as sophisticated as having the variable substitutions that Cold Spring allows, but it's kind of our sort of original hack job that we did in 2002, I guess, when we were building out the new Macromedia.com. Any other questions? Over there. Is there any way to have dynamic configuration in Cold Spring? Well, the substitution variables that Dave just mentioned is one possibility. I don't know how widespread in the XML file they are. I would probably be tempted to look at the problem in a bit more detail and see if there's a more elegant solution rather than trying to sort of hack Cold Spring configuration. It may well be that there's a different approach using multiple configurations and multiple factories that would allow you to do what you need. Because Cold Spring lets you have the idea of parent factories and child factories, so you can actually have multiple factory instances but still share the bean definitions across them. And that might be a more appropriate approach. Okay. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening, and we hope we will see you at CF United 2007. This has been a production by TerraTech Programming. For more information, go to www.cfunited.com.